KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. After many years of talking about it and a House bill approved this year, the New Mexico legislature has once again failed to approve long-sought-after legislation to legalize marijuana. The Senate failed to vote on the House bill today as the session ended at noon. Representatives Javier Martinez and Andrea Romero, sponsors of the marijuana bill approved in the House, said in a Friday statement, House Bill 12 puts forward New Mexico's best opportunity to establish a multi-million dollar industry with a framework that prioritizes social justice and equal opportunity for our communities. The governor's office raised the possibility of a special session to complete negotiations on marijuana legislation. A statement said the governor has made a commitment to sign a bill that represents our shared principles, and we welcome any avenue to do so. New Mexico is ready. Well, despite the disappointments over the failure yet again of the marijuana legislation, there were a number of long-sought-after victories in the session for Democrats. The approval of an aid in dying bill allowing those with a terminal illness to end their suffering. The removal of an outdated state abortion ban. A major reform to liquor laws, expanding licenses to restaurants that can only sell wine and beer right now. The approval of a ballot measure that will allow voters to decide if New Mexico should use more of its permanent fund to boost spending on early childhood and K-12 education, and perhaps the biggest achievement, despite enormous opposition from businesses and Republicans, the approval of mandated paid sick leave to take effect next July. Workers would get 1 hour of sick leave for every 30 hours worked, up to 64 hours a year. Nationwide, paid sick leave is provided in 15 other states. You can read all of our coverage on the New Mexico legislative session under the News tab at krwg.org. For 109 years since the legislature was founded, New Mexico did not have an African American state senator. This year, that changed when Harold Pope Jr. of Albuquerque took his seat representing the 23rd District. KUNM's Khalil Akulona caught up with the Air Force veteran to ask about what motivated a life of service and where he sees New Mexico's future.
You know, when I graduated high school, I didn't have the motivation to go to college, or I really didn't see myself going. I didn't see much as far as African-American males. I didn't have that mentorship, and I didn't see people that looked like me who were successful in my community. Mm-hmm. I got pushed by uncles that were married into the family who were actually in the military and the Army. They pushed me to go in the Air Force. I didn't want to go, but when I did, it was the best decision I ever made in my life because I saw people that looked like me. I had good mentors push me to try things that I would have not normally done. Mm-hmm. And once I did that, it helped me build a lot of confidence, take a lot of pride in the work that I did, and really just representing the country in public service. Once I retired, and even while I was in, you know, I got involved a little bit in nonprofit work, serving on some boards. I worked in the capacity of trying to get other folks elected and holding, you know, our legislative officials accountable to the needs of the community. There was a point to where I said, why don't I just step up and run?
Mm. Where do your family values fit? Did your time in the Air Force fortify what you learned at home?
I would say yes. It fortified, and I guess it added to them. Mm-hmm. So we struggled. I was the oldest of five.
Mm-hmm.
My mother worked as a waitress. She worked in the food area of a bowling alley. So we'd come home from school, and she'd be headed off to work. So we were kind of left to ourselves to kind of cook dinner and take care of each other. And that's a struggle you see everywhere, right? And mm-hmm. even worse right now with COVID.
Mm-hmm.
So I just learned the importance of family. I learned the importance of my mom just having to work and hard work. Going in the military just kind of fortified that selflessness,
mm-hmm.
putting something else above you. I really kind of take that now as service as a state senator. You know, it's about serving your community And that's not to say that every decision I make is going to make everyone happy, but I'm just always going to vote my conscience. And then my conscience is going to come from my background and how I was raised, but also listening to my community. Mm-hmm. That's what leadership is about. It's really taking a stand and making a decision and doing the best you can. So that's what I try to do.
This is a session unlike any other in the middle of a pandemic, kind of a wild one to be your first, to tell the truth. How has your experience been so far?
I was lucky, you know, in my election that there's 7 new freshman Democratic senators. So the benefit to that is that we're all sharing information.
Mm-hmm.
The negatives have been because of COVID, because of the pandemic, working in a virtual setting, not being able to interact as much. That's something that we're all dealing with and we're all facing. For us new folks, I think that's where it's been an issue. It's just hard to develop relationships over Zoom and over email.
Yes, it is. How can we increase the voices of representation across the state, not only in the legislature, but for all of New Mexico?
For me, it's my role to reach out, talk to folks, but also get other folks to participate and be part of the process. As an elected official, it's also my role to do my job and make people feel that we can actually do good in our communities, right?
Mm-hmm.
I would say from the constituent side and voter side, we need them to get more engaged. I like when I'm seeing the marches, the protests, and getting involved. That's one way.
Yeah.
But another way to get involved is to call your House rep, to call your legislator, call your county commissioner, city councilor. Show up to those meetings. Let them know where you stand. Because I will tell you, as an elected official, that's what moves people.
Mm.
If I'm thinking about voting one way, it's not going to be some lobbyist. It's not going to be some pressure from some higher government official. What's going to move me off my position is my community and what they care about.
Give me a scorecard. Where are we getting it right and where do we have to improve?
I would say it's about a 6.
Okay.
And that's not to criticize, but that's just to say that I think there was huge turnout in this last election. I still think there needs to be better engagement. To be fair, I'd also like to see what happens when we're out of the pandemic and COVID. To me, we've been kind of playing with the edges, right? Little things here, we're going to do this. To me, we just have not done enough.
That was Harold Pope Jr., the first African-American state senator in New Mexico history. Well, New Mexico's decision to update pandemic restrictions every 2 weeks with little notice has caused big problems for businesses. During the legislative session, relief has been provided that will be going to businesses and individuals. But there are still grave concerns, especially in our area. In depth, here's KRWG intern Sarah Rodriguez.
Local businesses have struggled over the past year to adjust to different COVID-19 restrictions in the state of New Mexico. The restaurant industry has taken some of the hardest hits with various opening guidelines. La Posta owner Tom Hutchinson describes the challenges that his restaurant has faced.
We've seen my industry impacted in ways that perhaps other industries haven't been, in terms of different levels of being open. Sales have been tremendously impacted, but more importantly, it's been a tremendous hardship on my staff. We started COVID with both restaurants. My employment was about 175 folks. We're down to maybe 100 now.
Current New Mexico guidelines divide counties into 4 color tiers consisting of red, yellow, green, and turquoise. Each color level provides significant differences in capacity restrictions for restaurants. Restaurants and businesses are given minimal notice to adjust when their county shifts tiers, says Hutchinson.
We're given zero notice. You know, we find out when the public finds out. You don't flip restaurants on with a switch on and off. It takes us a while to ramp up in terms of employment and inventory.
Local business and restaurant owner Marcy Dickerson also believes that the restaurant industry needs more notice to make these adjustments.
I believe that we deserve, you know, more heads up. We deserve more time in switching because, especially in the restaurant industry, you know, we have to order food. We have to order alcohol. We have to schedule staff. The 2-week yo-yo schedule really does cause a huge amount of hardship for restaurants and people in the hospitality industry.
With uncertainties over what color the county will shift to next, Dickerson states that restaurants always have to expect the unexpected.
The hardest part about the whole thing is not being able to know what's coming in the future, not being able to tell, you know, plan for the future, because you really are at the whims of, you know, people's interpretation of the numbers. So there's just a lot of people's livelihoods hanging in the balance of these numbers and the decisions being made by the governor.
The entertainment industry has also been hit hard by state COVID restrictions. Movie theaters and other large entertainment venues have remained closed for the past year. Allen Theaters Company President Russell Allen describes how this has affected Allen Theaters establishments across the state.
Well, we've been closed for 50 weeks, well, actually 50 and a half weeks. And for lack of a better word, it's been absolutely devastating and unreal. We've been open every day for 112 years, and now all of a sudden we're shut down for, oh, it's going to be a year plus, several months, I suspect, before it's all done.
Allen believes that Allen Theaters is equipped and prepared for a safe opening across New Mexico.
We have full control over when the showtimes start and when they finish, so we know exactly when you're going to show up and when you're going to leave. We have material or equipment that we can completely sanitize every single surface in every single auditorium after every single showing. We've purposely kept our crowds down so that we don't have to worry about lines. And those, of course, those things will automatically just translate right over to COVID policies.
Allen Theaters will be allowed to reopen when counties hit the turquoise tier. Allen believes that this will not happen anytime soon for Dona Ana County.
We won't open our theaters until there's turquoise, giving us a fallback to green. Dona Ana County and Bernalillo County, for that matter, up in Albuquerque, because of our population, will never hit green. It's not a possibility. So we should be able to get some other theaters opened around the state, but in Las Cruces, under the current guidelines of 8 cases per 100,000, we'll never see green.
Business owners are hopeful that there will be more flexibility with the COVID restrictions, says Hutchinson.
I was just hopeful that the governor could make some adjustments to give us, to create some more certainty. You know, sliding backwards is not a fun thing to do. And perhaps if they had given us a longer period to make that adjustment to get to maintain that 5% positivity rate, would have deflected all the disruption and chaos associated with closing a business down or at least changing the capacity levels.
New Mexico counties will continue to be evaluated on a biweekly basis to determine their tier color status. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Sarah Rodriguez.
Well, it's not just business owners. Some others are concerned about the lack of communication regarding some of the COVID-19 restrictions in New Mexico, including commentator Peter Goodman.
Our governor and Dr. David Scrace are navigating well among very dangerous shoals: COVID-19 spread, financial ruin, public emergency, and individual rights. It's a delicate piloting job, but I'm troubled by a few apparent missteps and more troubled by getting stiffed when I ask about them. Doing similar things in similar settings presents similar dangers. If a building has 80 seats and a platform someone presents from, the virus doesn't care if it's a play, political speech, or sermon, as long as folks keep their distance and wear masks. If political meetings that size were allowed, but religious services were not, we'd be drowning in headlines, protests, and lawsuits. I asked state officials why a small independent theater is more dangerous than a church. I sought some reasoned basis in science or plain good sense for this discrimination, something beyond political convenience. Our Constitution forbids discriminatory interference with exercise of religious faith, and it forbids establishment of religion. Supreme Court cases have recognized citizens' rights not to believe in supreme beings. Assuming the state's discrimination against non-religious groups is constitutional, it's still unfair. Sure, some people of faith feel strongly about attending church, but many folk find powerful instruction and community in a good play, well performed, or a thoughtful movie. So why is a small theater classed a large entertainment venue? I asked the governor's press secretary that. She sent me the list of categories and confirmed that a tiny theater is considered, quote, a large entertainment venue. Kind of like asking why a law forbade Ukrainians from owning dogs and being told, yes, you are a Ukrainian. Well, I know that, but why can't I have a dog? Again, I asked why. I tried for some more meaningful discussion. I got silence. This sort of arrogance is dangerous. Laws work if they make sense and folks see them enforced fairly. More than most, the Gov's health order depends on people buying into it and complying. Rules and enforcement that seem unfair undermine credibility. Saying follow the science is a great mantra, but officials have to be willing to discuss that science, as the Gov and her people were doing. Both fighting the virus and informed democracy are serious business. I also think a small business should have a reasonable way to resolve such issues. My theatrical friends and I believe in the science and generally approve the steps the state is taking. We just want small local enterprises to be treated equally or hear a rational explanation why they can't be. I know you're busy, guys, but many folks are on board but have serious questions. Ignore us, and you sacrifice a whole lot of credibility.
Peter Goodman's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. Well, speaking of the pandemic, all Las Cruces Public Schools students will have the opportunity to return to in-person learning starting on April 6th. In depth, here's Madison Staton.
Las Cruces School Board President Ray Jaramillo outlined the state school reopening directive prior to the board officially voting to certify the April 6th date of reentry.
On March 8th, 2021, the PED issued an expectation that all schools be in full reentry no later than April 5th. April 5th is a LCPS school holiday. Moreover, the PED considers full reentry to be satisfied with either 4 or 5 days a week of in-person learning.
Las Cruces Public Schools attorney Elena Gallegos says the board was left with little power to determine the timeline for reopening schools.
We're back into a situation where there does not appear to be choice. The expectation of the Secretary of Education is that we resume in-person learning. There's not the kind of choices we've had in the past. With that expectation, what we see happening with the PED from a legal standpoint is aligning itself with the CDC and with the federal law.
All students, regardless of whether they choose to return to the classroom, will work remotely on Wednesdays. Middle and high school online learners will be offered 45 minutes to an hour of academic support during the rest of the school week, prior to the arrival of in-person learners. Interim Superintendent Ralph Ramos says the new schedule will accommodate both online and in-person students.
It was kind of like trying to piece all the, you know, this huge puzzle to try to meet everyone's needs with the mandate of coming into the building with kids in person. We have some good systems already just based on what we've learned and how we've been conducting, you know, our learning in the classrooms with remote only. And I strongly believe that the asynchronous and synchronous instruction will also meet those needs.
School board member Maria Flores voiced concern about meeting the needs of remote learners.
I see that high school has an hour of instruction, again, versus a whole day of instruction for the ones that are in person. I just don't understand how that can be equitable. I really don't.
Fellow board member Terry Dahlman was the only member to not support the reentry, abstaining from the vote. She reminded the board that the pandemic is still ongoing.
Teachers had heard from administration that the pandemic was over. It is not over by any means. Plus, there are variants that are coming in as well. We don't know how those are going to react to, especially to our children.
She also expressed the need to protect district employees, saying staff needs to be able to take care of both their professional and personal responsibilities, exacerbated by the pandemic.
I've never been a fan of "we're all in this together." I'm not a fan of that slogan, but a lot of people are. And if you want to look at that now, we're not in this together because we're not supporting our staff members with their families. When you have a single parent that is taking care of a family member that has health issues and they can't be vaccinated, this is a real issue for them. We're not taking that into consideration.
1,824 of the over 3,330 district employees have reported receiving both doses of the COVID vaccine. 233 staff members have received one dose, while 324 employees opted out of vaccination. Interim Superintendent Ralph Ramos says the district is working on accommodations for those that will not be fully vaccinated by April 6th.
Every day, I know we have 200 vaccinations available for our LCPS employees, and we're maximizing on that, you know, to really do our due diligence to our employees on that. Now, on that note, let's say that come April 6th, there's still some employees that have not received the vaccination and are wanting to, and they're scheduled for, let's say, April the 8th to get it. We are working with those individuals.
The district is still calculating the number of students expected to return in person. Ramos says that the new schedule will require parents in the district to communicate with each other to ensure the health and safety of the district community.
I think the key thing here is communicating with each other, with what's happening.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
And you'll find the most comprehensive coverage of the pandemic anytime online at the region's homepage, krwg.org. KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Great to be with you. Some of the migrant families picked up by the Border Patrol in the Rio Grande Valley and flown to El Paso are being sent across the border to Mexico. KTEP's Angela Cocherga has that report.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection began flying migrants to El Paso last week to relieve overcrowding in processing facilities in South Texas. Migrant shelters in El Paso had expected as many as 270 people a day. But some of those migrant families were sent across the border to Juarez instead, as first reported by the Dallas Morning News. Enrique Valenzuela is coordinator of the Chihuahua Population Council, which provides humanitarian relief for migrants on the Mexican side of the border. He says it's the first time Central Americans who arrived in another Mexican border city have been sent to Juarez during the pandemic.
They crossed into the U.S. Through Reynosa, and they were sent here, we understand that, through Title 42. For some reason, they were sent back through this border, Juarez-El Paso border.
Title 42 allows the U.S. to quickly remove unauthorized migrants arriving at the border during the pandemic. CBP did not specify why some families flown to West Texas are being sent to Juarez and others are released in El Paso. According to a statement from CBP, migrants are moved to other Texas border cities to process individuals as safely and expeditiously as possible. I'm Angela Cocherga in El Paso.
Well, more on this now. Texas Governor Greg Abbott recently criticized what he called President Biden's, quote, open border policies, claiming they're leading to a crisis at the border in Texas. But the border is still closed to most migrants and asylum seekers. The federal government is even flying some migrants, as we said, from South Texas to El Paso and then expelling them back into Mexico. KERA's Mallory Falk recently visited a migrant shelter in Juarez, just across the border from El Paso.
Ingrid Munoz has been living at El Buen Samaritano Migrant Shelter in Juarez for 19 months, but today is her last day here. Tomorrow, she'll finally cross into the U.S.
No encuentro palabras porque es una gran alegría que siento en mi corazón.
She says she can't find words because there's so much happiness in her heart. Munoz says she fled violence in Guatemala with her husband and two children. But when they arrived at the U.S.-Mexico border, she says they were placed in the Remain in Mexico program. The family was sent back to Juarez to wait out their asylum proceedings. Now President Biden is unwinding the Trump-era policy. That means Munoz and her family can continue their case in the U.S. They'll stay with her older brother, who she hasn't seen in almost 20 years.
Abrazarlo mucho, muy fuerte, muy fuerte.
She says she'll hug him really hard. Nine others are also due to cross the border, so there's a flurry of activity. Families sit on the bunk beds where they've slept for so long, sorting through their things and packing what they can take.
Me regaló toalla. Me regaló ropita para la niña.
A woman named Ada Melendez was handed a few things for her three-year-old granddaughter, who happily twirls in her new light-up crown. She doesn't know if and when they'll be able to cross, because they arrived here when the border was already closed due to COVID-19. This health restriction, known as Title 42, has been used to keep out other migrants and asylum seekers.
Cuando yo llegué a la frontera, solamente nos dijeron de que íbamos bajo el título 42.
Including this Salvadoran mother, who asked that we not use her name out of fear for her safety.
Yo salí de mi país por razones de las pandillas.
She says she and her daughter fled El Salvador after being extorted by a gang. They crossed into El Paso but were turned away and sent back into Mexico. She worries about her daughter's long-term mental health. Some people have suggested sending the 11-year-old across the border alone. But she says she can't bring herself to do that.
No tengo la fuerza suficiente para dejar ir a mi hija.
Shelter director Juan Fierro says about a third of current residents were turned away at the border because of the pandemic, and more people keep coming.
¿Tienes azúcar?
They have to go through a quarantine and daily health check.
¿Dolor de pecho?
No.
¿Dolor de cabeza?
No.
Staffer Marta Esquivel takes their temperatures, asks if they have chest pains or headaches. For some, the U.S. is still far away, while for others, it's finally within reach. Like Ingrid Munoz, the asylum seeker from Guatemala, preparing to cross into the U.S. with her family and nine other residents. There are tearful hugs, people pose and snap cell phone pictures together. Some residents have formed close bonds here over nearly 2 years.
Soy una persona que se encariña con las demás personas.
Munoz's daughter, Lindsay, who's 13, says she's someone who gets really attached to people. She's going to miss her two closest friends here. But she's also excited to meet her uncle for the first time. She says she only knows him through photos.
Solo en fotos y no en persona.
A bus pulls up and the group lines up. Each person gets a big squirt of hand sanitizer before boarding. Other residents and shelter staff surround the bus and wave as it drives off. They stop to get tested for COVID-19. They have to test negative in order to enter the U.S. Then they're escorted across an international bridge into El Paso. Midpoint on the bridge is the boundary line separating the U.S. and Mexico. As Ingrid Munoz and others walk toward what they hope is a new life in America, they pass a group of migrants walking in the opposite direction into Juarez. They have just been expelled under Title 42. I'm Mallory Falk in Juarez.
And about a week ago, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy and other Republicans in Congress were in El Paso to draw attention to a recent increase in migrant crossings. Republican leaders blame the Biden administration for seeking to undo many of former President Donald Trump's immigration policies. But Democratic Congresswoman Veronica Escobar of El Paso told KERA that the surge, including more children, never stopped.
The Donald Trump administration didn't stop them. And what we are seeing today is the consequence of 4 years of dismantling every system in place to address this with humanity and compassion.
Homeland Security announced the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, will help process high levels of unaccompanied minors seeking U.S. entry at the border. An appeal has been filed to allow a New Mexico Indian tribe to use oral history in an important legal case. KUNM's Savannah Marr has more.
Some Indigenous history is preserved in stories, songs, and ceremonies that are passed down orally, rather than written records. Leaders of the Jemez Pueblo say oral histories prove its Aboriginal ties to Valles Caldera, an area of federally managed land in northern New Mexico. But in 2019, a district judge dismissed those histories as hearsay and struck down the Pueblo's land claim. The tribe has filed an appeal, and now 9 Indian law scholars have signed onto a brief arguing for the Pueblo's oral histories to be considered. This includes Robert Hershey with the University of Arizona School of Law. He says that dismissal was based in harmful stereotypes that cast Indigenous knowledge as primitive.
You can't divorce these stereotypes from the colonial structures, and by colonial structures I mean, for example, evidentiary rules that prevent the admission of a great amount of oral or traditional history in court.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Savannah Marr.
And funding for the Mountain West News Bureau provided in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Well, there has been a lot of pushback against President Joe Biden's 60-day oil and gas lease moratorium on public lands. As the New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown reports, while the fight continues, some conservatives say there's no point for taxpayers to lose money if the price of oil remains relatively low.
New Mexico Congresswoman Yvette Harrell introduced legislation to exempt the land of enchantment from the moratorium, citing potential job losses, and reduce funding for public education from the leases. Some conservatives, however, say it's appropriate for the Biden administration to end what they call the Trump administration's wasteful lease policies. Dave Jenkins with Conservatives for Responsible Stewardship says taxpayers shouldn't be losing money on the leases.
These oil companies have stockpiled thousands upon thousands of leases and permits that they haven't used. And so they're set for a while. So it makes no sense for us to just keep leasing when the price of oil is down.
According to Taxpayers for Common Sense, between 2010 and 2019, taxpayers lost out on more than $12 billion in revenue from drilling on public lands because of the federal government's outdated fiscal policies. The group noted that half of that money would have funded schools and other needed services. Jenkins says while oil prices plummeted throughout the pandemic, oil and gas companies were nonetheless granted leases with minimal drilling potential that will generate little, if any, revenue for New Mexico communities. He notes that even though the federal government leased an additional 10,000 New Mexico acres in 2020 than the year before, taxpayers lost money on the transactions.
In 2020, they leased out over 70,000 acres, but only brought in $31 million, $14 million difference, because they were trying to move those leases at a time when the demand was low for oil and the price was low.
The director of New Mexico's Oil Conservation Division has said the state can expect very little short-term impact from the freeze on oil and gas leases because the industry has hedged itself very well over the past couple of years. Meanwhile, New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham remains optimistic the state will not be punished for its high concentration of federal lands. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Finally, we continue our series with the New Mexico Rural Heritage Oral History Project. It's a collaboration between anthropologists at New Mexico State University and the Oral History Program at the New Mexico Farm and Ranch Heritage Museum in Las Cruces. The goal of the project was to record the memories of New Mexicans who grew up in rural parts of the state in the first half of the 20th century. This episode features some of our favorite stories about religion, illness, injury, and the many different kinds of home remedies.
For many people in the Southwest, religion, spirituality, and healing are intertwined. Whether it's because religion is part of a healing practice or because religion is often a way to cope with and make sense of illness and death. In the following stories, these themes often came together in some surprising ways. Grady McCullough was born in 1928 in San Angelo, Texas. He moved to House, New Mexico when he was 2 years old. His family were homesteaders. In this first clip, Grady talks about his local schoolhouse that also served as a church.
Our place was one of about three in the community that the kids gathered on Sunday afternoon. We had a community Sunday school and church in the schoolhouse. And the Methodist preacher preached on the first and third Sunday, and the Baptist on the second and fourth, and the Church of Christ on fifth Sundays.
Kay Bird was born April 7, 1928, in Savannah, Georgia. When the Depression hit, her father sent her and her sister to live with their grandfather in Elephant Butte. He later joined them and they moved to Hot Springs, or present-day Truth or Consequences. There, Kay and her sister would join the local church at the request of their friar.
There was a very small membership in the church, very small congregation, and the friar needed altar boys. Well, there weren't enough boys, so my sister and I were inducted. We were probably 7 and 8 years old, and we were also called altar boys. They pretended that we were girls, I guess, and we wore long black skirt for the services, long black skirts and white surplices with lace at the bottom, and we would usually just stand and look holy or something.
Unfortunately, this was also a time when polio was a huge concern, as little was known about the disease.
Once the friar conscripted us, he called my mother and said we were needed at the church for a service. So she sent us, and the service was a funeral for a little girl who had died at Carrie Tingley Hospital. And we, the altar boys, we had to wear our outfits and stand around the coffin. And I happened to be at the head of the coffin, and we were very uncomfortable. It was hot. It was miserably hot. And we were perspiring, and the incense made me kind of sick. The friar was very formal with everything. And there was incense, and I was standing there, and a fly landed on her face. She was a beautiful little girl with long blonde curls, and she was dressed in a beautiful pink dress, and the coffin was lined with white satin, and I thought all that was very beautiful. But this fly was falling on her face, and I was standing there, and I just couldn't stand it anymore. It crawled up her nose, and then it crawled out. I was going to pieces, and so finally I went like that, and the friar glared at me, so I didn't. And at that time, everyone was scared to death of polio. Everybody was scared to death. We didn't know how it was spread, and my mother would have been really unhappy to know that we were called to that funeral, because everyone was superstitious about polio. I went home and vomited, and I told my mother that I just kind of felt sick or something.
Different health concerns would require people to solve health issues creatively. Up next, we get an example from Ann Hoffman. Her family was originally from Michigan. They first moved to Arizona and then to New Mexico so that her father could be a missionary. She talks about a mother trying to solve her baby's nutritional needs.
This is Edith and Walter Jones.
She was showing a photo album during the interview and is referring to a few old photos of them.
Walter was a very big baby. He was in a cradle board. His mother, Edith, would come often to sew. And when she did, Walter would cry, cry. And my mother said to Edith, "You know, I think the baby's hungry." She was still breastfeeding him. He was very big. She said, "He's not getting enough to eat, Edith. Let's take him to the doctor." So we took him to the doctor. Doctor agreed with my mother, baby needed more food. And the answer, of course, was formula. So we went to the store and we bought bottles and nipples and, you know, everything she needed to make food. We showed her how and gave them to her, and she went home. She came back shortly after, and Walter was still crying and crying and crying. My mother said, "Are you giving him the formula?" Edith said, "He don't like it." And another characteristic or tradition was they never made their babies do anything for their children. That was just not done. And the children were, by and large, very well behaved. Mm-hmm. And so it was never a problem. But it was clear this wasn't going to work. Mm-hmm. And my mother, being really concerned about Walter's survival, kept encouraging Edith to do it. Mm-hmm. Well, then Edith got annoyed. And she didn't come back for quite a while. And when she came back, Walter was this fat little toddler running around all over the place. And my mother said, "What happened to Walter?" And Edith said, "Well," she explained, "they were sitting around fire in the hogan one night drinking coffee. And they always had a can, an open can of evaporated milk, their coffee. Well, Walter discovered the can, picked it up, and drank the whole thing down straight. And after that, they could not keep an open can of pet milk around because Walter would drink it. So Walter solved his own problem.
Home remedies were often used by families in rural New Mexico, as described in these next few clips. Here, once again, is Grady McCullough.
When I was, must have been about 4, I was sitting on what we called a go-devil. It's a sled with knives on the side, but at the back, you have 3 discs on each side that after the knives had cut the weeds in the bed, you went down, the sled went right down the furrow, straddling your crop. Then the disc pulled the dirt in on the crop to cultivate it. And I had caught a baby rabbit and was sitting on the seat of the cultivator, warm morning in summer. Evidently, I went half to sleep and fell off. And my dad fortunately looked back as he saw me fall and stopping the team, he stepped the opposite direction he was standing on the wings of the platform, and he stepped to the left side to lift the weight off so that it lifted the disc over. But the disc went here, across here, and across my leg. I bore scars of that. They pretty well disappeared in the 90 years since, but.
And what did you do during that time? Was there a hospital, or what did you do when something like that happened?
Fortunately, my mother had nurses training, was an LPN, and she took care of it with home remedies.
Jerry Navarez was born in 1952 in his grandmother's house in San Miguel, New Mexico. He had 6 siblings. Growing up, Jerry's family owned 14 acres of land south of La Mesa.
I still remember that for headaches, my mother would slice a potato, raw potato, with vinegar, and then with a handkerchief, she would put it on your head to kind of cure a headache. I don't know if that really works or not. Different things for your teeth or gum, you know, problems and things that I still don't remember exactly what was being used. For fever, and again, these are things that I saw basically, but the tomato, a raw tomato, boiling water, smashed up, put in a towel and they put it on the bottom of your feet, supposedly to draw out the fever. So it just depends. There were also people that were called curanderas that people would go to. You know, they would do different things.
Okay.
So either took care of it that way or you tried to make it to a doctor.
Rini Martinez was one of 11 children and was born and raised in Santa Fe. Her grandparents lived in El Rancho, New Mexico. She describes ways her grandmother would take everyday items and use them to heal.
Of course, on my grandmother and my dad's side, like I told you, she would use the beans and the potatoes and herbs, different herbs, which I don't remember those herbs, but she would, you know, like put them behind her ear here. And I remember her doing that, and we would laugh. Me and my sisters would laugh. I said, "Look at it, Grandma's putting beans on her face." Another thing she would use, at that time, she had smoked, and she would have the little, I'll never forget this, the package of cigarettes, it'd have a stamp on it, a little blue stamp. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
She'd easily pull off the stamp. And I don't know why it had to do whatever it meant. She would put stamps on our forehead too, the cigarette stamp. She would save them and she'd lick them and she'd put them on us. And you know, I never had a sore throat for the longest time. Mm-hmm. But I was, after a little older, I was very prone to sore throats, had bad sore throats.
Lucinda Vigil, Rini's cousin, also grew up in Santa Fe. She shares a story of a healing method using aceite volcánico, or volcanic oil, a type of elixir used for aches and pains. Lucinda was interviewed in her childhood home, which has now been converted into a restaurant called The Tea House. You may hear a bit of the dinner rush in the background.
I don't know if you've ever heard of aceite volcanico oil. It's a liniment, and my grandmother used to use that a lot. Like, if anybody broke their ribs, they would rub that on there. It smells like gasoline. And I remember my cousin Yolanda said to me one day, she said, you know, I was really sick in Taos. I was working as a ski instructor in Taos in 2000. And she said, if you take a spoon of that, of whole sugar, and put some of that aceite volcanico oil, that'll get rid of your cold. I couldn't smell, and I couldn't taste. And so I did it in front of all those young kids, and they were all like, are you crazy? It worked.
Bronson Springstead was born in 1936 in Chaco Canyon. His father, who went by the nickname Colonel, owned a trading post. Bronson remembers the different types of elixirs that were sold there.
They sold a lot of product called Mexican oil. And it was
good. A glass bottle.
Yes, a glass bottle. And they used it just about for everything. I mean, if you, you know, smashed your hand, well, you just rub some Mexican oil on it. If you had a headache, we'll rub that Mexican oil on your forehead. So Mexican oil was one of our big sellers. And tincture of mesylate had alcohol in it, burned. They sold a lot of that. It had a glass, not a dropper, a glass stem. You dip it in there and it was red. And you'd put it on a cut, just burned. I mean, really burned. But if somebody came in with a sore throat, really bad sore throat, my mother would take a pair of forceps-looking things with a cotton ball and soak it in that tincture methylate, had them open their mouth and just swab around their tonsils. And you talk about cure them, if it would. And then the other big seller was a mustard plaster. And there were squares about like this, and they were just in paper wrappers. So what you did is take the wrappers off and soak it in hot water, and then put that mustard plaster on their chest, and then they take the other layer of paper off and leave it on there until it dried.
Billy Poindexter was born on March 31st, 1932 in Portales, New Mexico. Billy's parents moved to New Mexico on a wagon. They would later have 13 children. One specific cure that Billy recalls involved solving a stomach ailment.
No, we didn't even know what doctors was. We had black draught. You know what black draught is? It's a kind of a powdery like snuff, and you take it, and then you set it on a two-holer all the time.
Just for reference, black draught is a laxative, and a two-holer is another name for an outhouse. Monty Shriver was born in El Dorado in 1934 and grew up in Aztec, New Mexico. Here, he talks about more home remedies, but also going into Farmington, New Mexico for surgeries.
Well, I remember I had ringworm roots, and they put turpentine on it, and I ran screaming through the house. Uh-huh. One time I went up, and apparently they'd had an operation, and you could smell the ether, chloroform. It was in the neighborhood, because that's what they used for anesthesia then. I remember I had to have my tonsils out in Farmington, and I just remember I had a very sore throat afterwards. But the concern was it would start bleeding back then. And back then it was pretty common for everyone to have their tonsils and adenoids out. I'm not even sure what adenoids are. But
Felipe Baca was born in 1928 and spent most of his childhood living in La Cienega and Galisteo. He talks about a different type of health concern, one that involved supernatural elements.
The belief was that if you named Juan or Juanita, and at that time there was a lot of witchcraft done, you know. Everybody practiced witchcraft. And if somebody was trying to practice witchcraft on you, and you surrounded that particular item or animal or whatever it was, you put your clothes inside out. If your name is Juan, you know, or Juanita, and you draw a circle around it, wherever the animal is, with your foot, dragging your foot, you know. And that animal will come and run and stop at that line and go right back. He will not cross that line.
Luis Cabaldon was born in 1940 and grew up in Irizarry, south of Tejeras, in the 1950s. He also addresses having to deal with witchcraft.
The only thing I
sort of remember, not very well, they would talk about hanging crosses on over the windows, over the walls, to keep the witches out. And also, now that reminds me of a pine tree that was sitting right close to the wall. And there was this owl that hung out there. And they said that they were superstitious, I guess. They thought that might have been a witch. And in order to kill that witch, the old man had to put a cross on the bullet of his, I don't know if he took a bit, I think it was a rifle that he took out there and tried to shoot that owl, but he'd already made a cross on the bullet. I never heard the shot. I never knew anything whether he shot the owl or not.
For many in rural New Mexico, religion and health go hand in hand. For example, Kay Bird's earlier story where she was asked to be a part of a funeral service during the polio epidemic. To wrap up this episode, we have Amado Mares, who was born in 1934, and Labeo Martinez, who was born in 1930. They each talk about funerary practices in the early 1900s.
I remember going to one funeral here when I was maybe 4 or 5 years old. And we went in a wagon to the Espinosa Ranch here, 2 miles. And all I remember is that we got there. Her name was, I can't remember her name. She was pretty old. I remember we got there in a wagon. My dad went, I don't know, a miracle. He was with us that night. We went like in the early, we got there in the early evening. And I remember all these men had a big bonfire outside. And I remember they were passing a little bottle, probably moonshine, or maybe whiskey, I don't know. They were passing it around. And they weren't having any problems at all. And the body was inside one of the bedrooms. And one of the men, his name was Valentin Trujillo. He was doing the singing. I guess you've heard of the alabados, you know, like a chant, but they were words. And he was pretty good at it. And I remember that he was kneeling down in the room singing to her, like a farewell deal, you know. And I walked in, and this is kind of haunting. I got a little scared, but I enjoyed the voice, a real rich voice. And I was there like maybe an hour listening. And I was going back and forth, and it was already starting to smell, because she'd been there like six days. Out of respect, and everybody was there, you know, neighbors. And then later on, I guess around midnight, we'd come home.
Labeo mentions that most people in those days died relatively young. His grandmother passed away in her 70s. He talks about her funeral service when he was a young boy.
I remember I was like 8 years old, and she died like at 4 or 5 in the afternoon. She died at home in the bed right there. And I remember the neighbors coming over and stuff like that. Over the night, they got her ready, and they dressed her, and all the men got together and were building a box of casket in the porch. Later at night, they put in the casket. They not only built the casket, but the ladies put some nice clothes on the outside to make it look nice and everything. And they put her in the casket. And I remember just carrying the casket to the church the next morning into the cemetery. In other words, you have to do everything before 24 hours.
That concludes this episode of the New Mexico Rural Heritage Oral History Project. All interviews were conducted or supervised by Kelly Jenks, Mary Alice Scott, Kayla Archuleta Brown, and Mariah Ballard. On behalf of New Mexico State University, I'm Jose Loera. Thank you for tuning in.
And that is KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, KRXG Silver City.